Now I know why Forrest had me speak last. I'd like to thank you very much for, and particularly Bill Campbell, for having invited me. It's a great pleasure, particularly to be in the same room with Stan Evans and to be on a panel with Forrest MacDonald. Forrest is one of my heroes, and Forrest, along with Irving Kristol and Joseph Hamburger, are partly responsible for the pain you may suffer in the next 20 minutes, because without him, without Joseph Hamburger, and without Irving Kristol, I would have never made it through graduate school, and I'd be continuing to fix cars. Forrest not only read my manuscript, he gave me invaluable advice before it went to press, and I've always considered him one of my great heroes. And in order for this panel, I in fact started rereading for the third time E Pluribus Unum, and I'm again as much impressed now as I was 20 years ago, or nearly 20 years ago. He's really a great gift to the American academic environment. I also like to suggest that I was going to ask for your forgiveness in terms of the talk I'm about to give on two levels. One, for the fact that I'm likely to insult some, if not many of you. Others decided to do the same thing that I'm going to do, but at least be worth remembering that that's not what it meant. It didn't mean many immigrants coming together to form one America. It meant states that are distinct corporate sovereign identity coming together to form one overarching national to replace their one overarching imperial government. It's worth remembering that, in fact, that's not what it meant, the way we're interpreting it. That isn't what it meant when we coined back over 200 years ago. But I will continue along the themes that earlier panels have enunciated and my co-panelists have, in terms of misinterpreting it willfully. But we should keep in mind that we are misinterpreting it. We're giving it a new meaning, one that has nothing to do with its authentic historical meaning. What I'm going to do in my talk, I'm going to try to map out my understanding of what makes an American. I'm also going to celebrate it for the ability that America has had to create diverse peoples from and into an American. I'm going to suggest how partisans of the left and right are doing damage to this concept, and close with a plea for renewed focus on exactly how America has done what it's done, and particularly a plea that we fight to recover American universities and particularly American history, which I think is in great difficulty, and our ability to understand ourselves, our ability to explain ourselves to our children is going to be lost when the generation of historians that Forrest represents, almost all who are over 60, almost all either retired or soon to retire, do retire. They're not going to be replaced. And I'm sorry to say, political theorists are incompetent, not trained, and unwilling to fulfill the duties and services that they are capable of doing. The fact that almost all the people on the panels today are political scientists is in fact something sad. And that historians can't do it or won't do it is in itself sad as well. What I'd like to describe as American is something follows Thomas Sowell, is that America has consistently transformed wave after wave of immigrants into Americans. The question then has to be raised, what is it that they're being transformed into? I think the answer, quite simply, is the turning of other peoples into an entity capable of self-government. Americans from 1620 till today, I think, largely are defined by that soul, and if not soul, at least that identifying characteristic understood in multiple dimensions. Self-government as individuals, self-government as self-regulating families and groups, and ultimately self-government as a national people. This meant that the demands of both individual and group wants, which are illimitable, in fact, had to learn to be limited. Groups overlapping in their constituency would, in fact, constrain individuals and had done so in American history, again, for over 300 years. It was the British authorities' attempt to suspend American self-government, as reported by both learned and unlearned Americans alike, that ultimately led to the political break with the peoples of North America and Britain. What is so impressive about Americans is their ability to live with freedom and exercise it on the whole as ordered liberty rather than license. That is, Americans, while exercising mutually reinforcing restraints, have kept freedom within the boundaries imposed by the responsible exercise of liberty. This means as well that unlike continental Europeans, Americans are a people who have lived with a certain measure of hierarchy without either being captivated by it or reactively opposed to it. As our Puritan and revolutionary forebears made clear, their goal was not the creation of a democratic governance, but a popular governance in which the voice of the many and the voice of the accomplished few could both be duly heard. Often forgotten, and I think this was demonstrated earlier today, the movements that led to Americans' independence from Great Britain and the adoption of our current Constitution were powerfully shaped by conservatives, whom conservatives seem to have no interest in, who were as concerned with preventing the rise of democratic governance as they were in defending the right of Americans to govern themselves. Those are the twin goals of most Americans up until the end or the middle of 1776, from the beginning of the crisis in 1760. And yet we've forgotten it. And above all else, conservatives have forgotten it. Why? As a cursed examination of the history of modern France demonstrates, being able to live with freedom and a measured degree of hierarchy are not skills universally present among Europeans, to say nothing of others. Yet again, what is striking about America, both past and present, has been its ability to transform various peoples within 1 to 3 generations into individuals capable of self-government, into Americans. It is clear that whatever it is that helps immigrants in America develop these skills, it has worked. We may disagree about what it is that has done this transformation, but we should not disagree about what has occurred. In my opinion, what is it that lies at the foundation of this culture that has so successfully turned men and women, or at least their grandchildren, into self-governing individuals and groups is the following. I've argued this for over a decade now, rather tediously, and please forgive me that I'm going to do so again. But I'm going to suggest it's the formative power of 3 basic constituent elements. 1, of a Hebraic Reformed Protestantism, embedded in an English legal and political order, with an added emphasis, 3, on joint stock legal codes and charter-derived political structures. These structures were largely accidental, a product of our English migration. They weren't well thought out, they weren't intended, they were in fact an accident that maybe one might wish to describe as providential. They came together in ways in America that were unpredicted, unpredictable, and in fact remarkably quite marvelous. No one planned it, no one understood the consequences. It did come together and it has worked. But again, they were largely accidental. They produce a populist, localist, legalist, egalitarian, entrepreneurial, and rather vulgar culture that by the end of the 18th century had begun to distinguish colonists from metropolitan British. Even as the religious impulse lessens in some, though in fact very few, at the end of the 18th century, the central liturgical, and that means Puritan, it has to do with aesthetic standards, theological, Augustinian, having to do with the concept of original sin, and ecclesiastical elements, which are congregational, meaning that only local units of self-governing churches, in fact, are capable of acting in behest of the Holy Spirit. These features of Reformed Protestantism, along with English legal and constitutional forms and institutions, continue to shape the American political, legal, and cultural landscape far past the end of the 18th century. Parenthetically, let me add, America has also been importantly shaped by what it lacked: Catholicism, entrenched feudal aristocracy, and close and warring neighbors. America, I believe, has continued to produce Americans out of disparate peoples because of the continued power of its largely reformed and pietistic Protestantism and its English legal and political inheritance, and the lived nature of these norms and institutions is shaped by Americans' geography economic resources, and the self-same diverse peoples. America is a marvelous, exceptional, even miraculous creation. It wasn't intended, it wasn't designed, it occurred. If you're religiously so disposed, you can view it as providential. I tend to view it as accidental. Yet many of our forefathers, such as Benjamin Franklin, believed that only Englishmen could fully live the life developed by their cousins in America. We now know that they were wrong, and that Southern European serfs, Catholics of all sorts, ill-mannered Russian Jews, Chinese and Japanese deferential peasants, and women can be transformed into self-governing citizens. America thus truly has been a light unto the world in demonstrating that most men and women, when properly enculturated, corporately constrained, and living under short chains of responsible hierarchy, are capable of self-government. We have proved it, and it's a miracle. America has proved that its culture and its inherited norms and political institutions can be adopted by almost all peoples when they're properly embedded in a receptive host culture. But based on the same experience, there is no reason to believe that the norms and institutions that America has developed, by intention or, I would urge, more often by happenstance, can work to produce the same results without appropriate cultural antecedents. As contemporary Japan and Germany suggest, under the right conditions, much can be accomplished in achieving similar results elsewhere with such elements, even if different from our own, are present. Most of our national history, America has been characterized very differently than that found in the portrait sketched here by my colleagues and by many today, but not all. Instead, we're told that America is exceptional in being a nation founded not on a particular cultural model, a unique history, or distinct religious and political institutions, but rather on an idea that is universal and readily transplantable to other lands with little concern whether the receiving culture is hospitable or the people prepared to exercise freedom responsibly. America's beliefs embody the idea of individual equality as derived from some distant work of political philosophy that can explain what Americans fail to express in their lived lives or in most public documents. In this rendering of American history, Americans are not a people preeminently formed by Reformed Protestant and Pietistic religious inheritance and English historical political rites and institutions, but instead by a secular theology, a rarefied individualistic political philosophy, and abstract rights and political institutions. This universal language of abstract rights and innate equality, freedom unconstrained, was surprisingly viewed, as I suggested this morning, with disdain by most American conservatives who occupied probably close to the majority, if not the majority, in all the middle colonies and in most other states, at least half of the population. And instead embraced enthusiastically by French authors and those Americans most influenced by them. In a perverse way, select American elite borrowed their self-understanding from the French so that America might become the universal model upon which the French and others might build utopian edifices. There's a body of history that's coming out and has been coming out the last 10 years about the intimate relation between French and Americans during the late 18th century and middle 19th century. It's a remarkably perverse history, and the relationship is one that is unchanged. How the French imposed their vision on America, find America disappointing for not being what they thought it was, and then hate us for it. Nothing has changed from 1760 and Buffon to today. This vision of America is embraced by both theory-intoxicated partisans of the left, but more surprisingly and disappointingly, also by conservatives who otherwise distance themselves from French revolutionary thought. Let me suggest, therefore, that a robust understanding of America's exceptional features is endangered not only by those on the cultural and political left, but as well by many on the right. On the left stand cosmopolitan liberal universalists who in recent polls castigated America as one of the most morally defective and dangerous of all nations. This largely results from America's continued adherence to evangelical Protestantism, nationalism, market capitalism, and worst of all, a mild version of democratic populism. From the perspective of European elites, embedded in their post-Catholic internationalisms, Europeans sacrificed much of the 20th century experimenting with nationalism, capitalism, and some measure of democratic populism. And after millions of deaths and untold destruction, they rightly have concluded that these experiments in Europe failed. Accordingly, Western European elite are returning to tried and true ways of, one, elite-controlled internationalism, married, two, to a universal secularism, and three, economic direction, dirigism in French. European hostility towards America is readily understandable when framed against America's success and European failure in creating a level of popular government that Europeans can only marvel at or disdain for its admitted vulgarity. I would urge all to travel to Europe as soon as possible. It's a remarkable opportunity to watch a society commit suicide. And it's something that everyone should take advantage of because they're unlikely to be repeated. A population that does not have children, doesn't like much to work, doesn't like wars too much, certainly doesn't like churches. Almost all the integral elements that allow for societies to continue is missing in Europe. And if you go to Amsterdam or to Den Haag, walk around the streets and see how many people look like they're Dutch. Nearly none. And they don't know how to do what we do, which is to turn others into theirs. We do, they don't, they're dying. But as suggested above, I spent 6 months in Europe, and as one of our earlier speakers said, they're always surprised to find Americans who don't seem to think like they do. They're even more surprised when they speak French and German. They're very surprised. But as suggested above, America's exceptional political culture is not only under attack from the left, but is being diminished by the embrace of friends on the right. Following the likes of Jefferson and Lincoln, contemporary defenders of America who insist on understanding America through the lens of the political texts are narrowing America's self-understanding and making less understandable the rich traditionalism, historical complexities, and Hebraic particularism that has made this country able to manage diverse pools of immigrants and transform them into Americans. A correct understanding of America cannot be had by having high school students and teachers memorize the catechisms of political partisans working in ideologically driven think tanks, or by reading texts of distant and largely irrelevant high political philosophy. Instead, a vibrant understanding of this nation's fostering of popular self-governance, of ordered liberty, can only be accomplished through close study of Americans' lived norms and institutions and their historical development. John Locke, no matter how masterfully read, cannot explain the changing and variegated response of 13 deeply divided colonies in their imperial relations with Britain. He can't. They're different, they change, they're over time. No static text can. What is needed then is a turning away from the artificial American landscapes painted by political theorists bearer of the necessary training and methodological tools to explore an America, one, without great works of political thought, and two, few of any great authors, and instead a return to intensive, micro, and close study of American history. Political theorists can't do it, and historians are not doing it. We are, in short, a people losing a sense of who we were. The authentic features of American history are far more interesting and illuminating than the bizarrely painted barren histories offered by political theorists overly committed to the importance of great works in political philosophy. America's war of separation from Britain and France's Revolution, for example, offer wonderful materials for better understanding the dangers of too rapid a democratization. Such an account, when fully developed, could guide us in better understanding why the French Revolution, with its universalism and abstract rights, was so unsuccessful, and our minimally ambitious War of Independence, with its late and not wholly convincing articulation of similar claims, was so much more successful. Thus, to understand the genius of America and its unparalleled ability to produce Americans from disparate materials, friends of America must encourage the renewed study of American history and culture, a new American studies. In fact, at a college like Colgate where I teach, one of the few areas one cannot study is America. The political history and religion of its dominant white populations is not taught. The sociology of its current majority population is not taught. The politics of state and localities is not taught. You can study Islam, you can study African American and Native American religion, you cannot study American Protestantism. Accordingly, as the NEH in a recent symposium discovered, what is sorely needed is a renewed focus on the study of American history and culture by scholars unguided by the fashionable political sensibilities of the left or right. Unfortunately, in spite of the splendid efforts of the NEH and the Earhart, Liberty Fund, Bradley, and Olin foundations, vastly more needs to be done. The current turn to insular university centers without permanent lines, populated by improperly trained political theorists who confuse their overly broad teaching activities with necessarily narrower scholarly ones, is not the answer. In fact, such centers are destructive in their overemphasis on the guiding role of political philosophy in the creation of America. But far more pernicious, though, is their propaganda value to politicize university administrations who use them in defending their political agendas before incensed but easily misled alumni. Let me close by again making this plea. A new American studies must be moved to the center of university and college curriculum, and this must occur before the current generation of professional historians, such as the like in the early American era of Professors McDonald, Wood, Balin, Morgan, and Green, withdraw from active scholarship. Once they're gone, a critical resource will be lost. With their prestige and knowledge following perversely in the footsteps, I would argue, in the pioneers of women's studies programs, they can help shape and lend credibility to the creation of new programs in American studies with appropriate links to and financial incentives for those working in other fields of study. As well, increased formation of scholars in regularly constituted departments can be enhanced by means of graduate and early professional support, much of this thankfully has already begun. Only in this way, by once again returning to the study of American history, will we understand America's genius, will we understand how it is that America, so much unlike Europeans, is able to turn the one, the few, into the many. Excuse me, the many into the one.